This week's Torah Away has been sponsored by family S. Bodner, Yisbodov Nisuim, Shel Osher Simyatsky, and Malka Bodner. Base Adar Sheni, Tuesday the 8th of March. Today's shiur is given Bischus Miras Finkel, Bas Gippel, who's having a major operation. This is the wife of Mr. Kaufman. Rabbi Dr. David Gottlieb, the connection between Purim and Yom Kippur.
There are elements of Purim that we're all aware of and need explanation. From what on the surface are the most sublime to what on the surface the most trivial, and yet I think we'll see that they all have an explanation as expressing a single important central idea. As everyone knows, the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not appear in Megillas Esther. There's only a remez that when the word Melech is used without saying a Melech HaChashverosh, it also refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, also refers to HaChashverosh, also refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that would mean that it's one of only two Sfarim in the entire Tanakh in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name does not appear explicitly. Second of all, why is the Sefer called Lefi Ha'am Megillah? Ha Megillah. We really have five Megillahs. Shir HaShirim, Koheles, Eicha, and Rus. There are five Megillahs. But Ha Megillah is Megillah Sest. Then, why do people get dressed up in costumes? I think here you can understand very well, it doesn't express the normal kovod rosh of a yid to engage in general hilarity, but why customs particularly, which is, I think, very widespread minhag. And also, why is there a minhag to eat kreplach on Purim? There are other days in the year we should eat kreplach, but specifically on Purim, it's a minhag to eat kreplach. And then why is there a mitzvah of getting drunk? I don't mean now, as the Rav explained, the halachic background, which is well known, but the gedank is meraf sanigre. How can you imagine an avoda of getting drunk? Talk about kovod rosh. The kovod rosh and the consciousness and the focus and the control is gone entirely. How can there be a mitzvah of getting drunk? And finally, the reason for the title is a well-known vort of the Arizal, that when the Torah Kedosh describes Yom Kippur, it never calls it Yom Kippur, never. It's always called Yom Kippurim. And by the way, you should ask, why is it in the plural? Why? What's the chat of it being in the plural? One of the Achronim comments on it, but as far as I know, there's no Chazal that explains it. The Mikos Kedolos don't even ask the question, why is it in the plural? They had written Yom Kippur, we would all been very happy with that. And the Rizal says, you could read the word Yom Kippurim, a day like Purim. Now this is doubly surprising. First of all, when you think of the 2 days of the year, I don't think there are a pair of days that are more disparate, separate, divided in Yom Kippur and Purim. Just think of the experiences of the 2 days, and they are a vast contrast. But even more so, if we're medayik in the idea, when you say that A is like B, that's not the same as saying B is like A. And neither is the same as saying that A and B are similar. When you say A is like B, what you mean is B has some quality, and A approximates the quality that B has. It approximates. But B has the quality in a more powerful, more ideal form, and A only approximates it. Now we're being told is that Yom Kippur is a day like Purim, which means Yom Kippur is being compared to Purim. So there has to be some quality that Purim has, and Purim has it stronger. Purim has it a purer, more ideal fashion, and Yom Kippur only approximates that quality that Purim has. And that really is a puzzle that needs to be unwrapped. I think that all of these questions can be answered with a single gedanke, a single insight. If we analyze the Nes of Purim, what kind of a Nes was it? Nes of Purim has a special structure, almost unique. Hanukkah is similar in certain ways, though not identical, in its own detailed structure. The Nes of Purim is unique. Let's put ourselves in the place of the people who lived through the events and ask ourselves, how would we respond to those events as they unfolded? Achashverosh throws a party for 6 months, and the week afterwards for the people of Shushan. And in a drunken state, he calls for an appearance of the queen, and she refuses to come, and she's deposed. In the text she's deposed, Chazal tells us that she was killed. Now imagine that we experienced that. What would we think? Well, he's an Oriental zhlub, and a lowlife, and he lives like an animal. And this is politics, and there was an intrigue because she was the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar, and he wanted to assert his power. This is normal Oriental politics and low degraded living. Would we think of it as a nes? I don't think we would have any clue that it was a nes. Then they do a beauty search, and Esther is chosen to be the new queen. Well, it's true that the probability of her being chosen is very low, but then the probability of any girl being chosen is very low. A lottery is an event designed to produce an event of low probability. Somebody had to be chosen. Whoever it would be a low probability. Any reason to think that Esther's being chosen is a nes? She keeps her identity secret. That's surprising. You'd expect some investigative reporter for the Shushan Times to dig up her past, and they're unsuccessful in so doing, even in spite of the incentives given by the king. That's odd, but don't think anyone would regard it as a miracle. Then Mordechai overhears the plot against the king's life, and because he speaks that foreign language, he understands it, he passes the idea on to Esther, and the king's life is saved. People are plotting against kings all the time. Most of the time, the kings avoid the plots, otherwise it would hardly pay to be king, because your reign would be very short. So this is another plot, and another successful foiling of a plot. Would we think that a miracle had taken place? And then the king doesn't reward Mordechai. That is passing strange. One would expect the king to reward people who save his lives in order to encourage people to save his life. But then Mordechai is a member of a downtrodden people of the entire empire. It's the only people that has no land of its own, that's in exile, and that's degraded by the destruction. And he decides not to reward Mordechai. I don't think any of these events would be regarded as a nes had we lived through them. But then Haman conceives a hatred for Mordechai and concocts a decree against the whole Jewish people and can't wait for Adar. And he wants Mordechai killed right away, and wants to come into the king in the night time to kill Mordechai. And that night, the king can't sleep. And because he can't sleep, he calls for the history books to be read, because as everyone knows, history puts you to sleep. And it's opened specifically to that page, which describes the fact that 4 years before, Mordechai saved the king's life, and he's suddenly struck by a bad conscience. Why didn't I reward Mordechai? And he decides to reward him, and then Haman is used. At that point, I think the reader begins to feel this is too contrived. It's not possible that this should happen by accident. It's much too contrived. If you wrote a novel with this plot, I think the editors at this point would say, this is not believable, you have to change this part of the scenario. It's not realistic. And that indeed is the point of the story. Indeed, it is not realistic. Indeed, it is not reasonable. Because it isn't happening naturalistically. This is the beginning of the nes. And of course, Esther is the queen, and she's there to save the Jewish people. At the end of the story, you see clearly that a nes is taking place. Now, here's the payoff. After you see at the end of the story that a nes is taking place, you go back to the events from the beginning, and you say, look, Esther is in place to save the Jewish people. How did she get there? She got there because Ahasuerus threw a party, and because he wanted the queen to make an appearance. And she didn't make an appearance, and he had her removed and killed. Had that all that happened, then Esther wouldn't have been in the place that she was. So apparently, those events were orchestrated by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even though when we experienced them, we didn't see them that way. We didn't analyze them that way. But post facto, looking backwards, the Mafreya we can say, yes, that was organized. And when Haman, and when Mordechai overheard the plot, and he passed it on to Esther, wasn't an accident that he was standing there, and that they were conversing in that language, and he knew the language. And it wasn't an accident that the king didn't reward Mordechai. No. His forgetting to reward Mordechai was also Hashkacha Pratis, so that 4 years later, when the history will be read, the king will be then struck by a bad conscience and want to reward him. So we go back and look at all those events that looked like happenstance. They looked arbitrary. They looked purely natural, unguided, and we now see that in fact they were Hashkacha Pratis. From the beginning to the end, they were Hashkacha Pratis. That's the message of Purim. The message of Purim is that when you're living Behesta Pari, they're living in Golis. This took place in Golis Bavel, in Persia. Time of Golis is the time when you don't see a Kodesh Baruch Hu's Hashgacha. That doesn't mean it isn't there. That means you have to look more deeply. You have to penetrate behind, shall I say, the mask, penetrate behind the costume, which normally conceals the other person's identity. You have to penetrate behind and see the Hashgacha when it isn't open and obvious. So, the sefer in which the story is written is a sefer in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name does not appear explicitly. If it were to appear, that would be a signal to understand that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is orchestrating events in an open way. It isn't happening that way here. Here it's not happening in an open way. It's called Megillah because the word Megillah means to reveal. Legalos. And this Megillah reveals what's normally hidden in a way that the other Megillahs don't. The costumes are obvious, as I've just explained. Kreplach. What are kreplach? A kreplach is a piece of meat wrapped in dough. If you're not familiar with this food, you look at it as if it were a matzo ball. It's just a piece of dough. Ah, no. It's a piece of dough and there's meat inside. If you penetrate beneath the covering of dough, you'll find a piece of meat. It's the same theme throughout. Now, what about drinking? And what does it mean that Yom Kippur and Purim are related? The goal of Avodas Hashem, 363 days per year, is to integrate the goof into the Avodah that's dictated by the Neshama. To elevate the goof, to uplift the goof, to focus the goof, control the goof, so that we'll express the Avodah that the Neshama needs to do. 363 days a year are two-dimensional. They address the Neshama and the goof and how they should be related. 2 days a year are one-dimensional. They're one-dimensional. Each one is devoted to one of the two and not the pair. Yom Kippur is devoted to the Neshama. The goof, as we all know, is put on the side. Back burner. No eating, no drinking. No shoes, no washing, no tashu shamita. That means that the goof is simply ignored. And as you all know, you have experienced it in the time. And Yom Kippur, the goof doesn't suffer. On the contrary, normally healthy people are not hungry or thirsty on Yom Kippur. Comes to Ne'ilah, nobody's thinking 25 minutes to the Coke. That's not how you experience it in Ne'ilah. Ne'ilah is... You are kula ruchni. The ruach carries the goof, and the goof just doesn't need. It doesn't register the lack of food and drink and the rest. It's a day of the neshama. Purim is fakert. By drinking, we blot out the neshama's control of the goof, the normal use of bechira, focus, yiras Hashem, that's blotted out by getting drunk. And the goof expresses itself naturally, in its own way. What is the purpose of doing that? The purpose of doing that is the following. Let's say you're observing a tzaddik. And this is a real tzaddik. Let's say even a tzaddik gomer. Everything he does is right. Everything he does is according to Shulchan Aruch, the Sifrei Musar. Everything he does is right. That means his goof does not succeed in tripping him up ever. Still there's an ambiguity in his avoda. Is it that his goof, like the normal goof of everyone, rebels, wants what it wants, would, if left to its own devices, be hefker. But he's very strong. He's very focused. And he forces, guides, points the goof in the right direction so that everything he does is right. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that throughout a lifetime of focusing and elevating and forcing and guiding, the goof also becomes ruchni. The goof also becomes kodosh. The goof absorbs the kedusha and the tahara of the neshama of the tzaddik, and then the goof also wants what's holy. The goof also wants what's right. Is that possible? If I look at a tzaddik from the outside, there's no way to know. He might be of category one, where the goof is still rebellious, but he overpowers it and controls it and focuses it. Or it might be of category two, where the goof itself has taken on the tchunos of neshama, the tchunos of ruchnius. How can you tell the difference when you blot out the control of the neshama? If the neshama is no longer controlling the goof, and the goof expresses itself in its own way, then you can see what the goof is. Those who have experienced great people on Purim, who have gotten drunk, it's like a vision from another world. It's a revelation. What comes out is Avas Yisrael, and Avas Hashem, and Avas Avas HaTorah, and poetry, and feelings of love, which perhaps a person is, under other conditions, more normally restrained. You see the kedusha that the goof is capable of absorbing from the avodah of a tzaddik. Now, this then does a double job. On the one hand, it's the day of the goof. It's a one-dimensional day. The control of the neshama is blotted out. But the one-dimensionality of Purim is utterly different from the one-dimensionality of Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur becomes the day of the neshama by putting the goof on the side, putting the goof in the back, denying the goof expression. The picture of Yom Kippur is the neshama and goof are different. They're different, and they stand in opposition to one another. And if you want to have a day that's dedicated to the neshama, the goof has to be sidelined. It has to be sidelined, discarded, depressed. On Purim, you have a revelation that there aren't really two. They aren't really two opposed elements. But that the goof is also neshamadik. The goof is also capable of absorbing kedusha. There's a picture of unity of the two sides. You don't achieve a day of the goof by blotting out the neshama and allowing an antithetical element to express itself. What you learn is that that other element, the goof, isn't really antithetical. And I think this is a direct expression of Achdus HaBayrei. As monotheists, we believe that everything has one source. The goof has exactly the same source as the neshama. It's all nivra from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which means that it can't be opposed to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's goals. It has to be an expression of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's goals. And the purpose of drinking is to reveal the fact that there's one source and one theme throughout the entire Bria. And that's why it's Yom Kippurim. Yom Kippur is one-dimensional, but it's one-dimensional in emphasis, whereas the reality is still two-dimensional. There's a goof in the neshama, and only the neshama is being given expression. Purim is more profound. Purim reveals that ultimately it's one dimension in the Bria. Not two and one is discarded, but it's one dimension in the Bria. The Kedusha, the Tara can saturate the goof as well. That, I think, is on the surface what the statement from the Arizal is supposed to teach us. There's one more idea that I want to share with you, which also relates to what's being revealed and what's being hidden. This is an idea that's found in Rav Dessler. It's a really important idea for us, and I want to add one final element, which I believe Aniyazdat he meant. It just isn't written. Rav Dessler wants to see in the Megillah an expression of Das Torah. How one should relate to Das Torah. The problem of the Megillah starts, even before the story, with the Sun of Achashverosh and the reaction of the Yidden to the plan of the Suda. The Suda is announced, representatives of all the nations are going to be present at the Suda. And a group of Yidden come to Mordechai, and they say to him, what shall we do about this? The emperor is making a celebration. He's inviting representatives of all of the nations, the 127 groups that he's emperor over. Shall we join? Mordechai says, no. And they say, but if we're the only ones missing, how's it going to look? Won't it be obvious that we don't identify with him, that we're not loyal to him? Won't it call down all sorts of political consequences on our heads? And Mordechai says, I'm telling you not to go. What's their reaction? We're going anyway. Mordechai is an ivory tower scholar. He's writing his memoirs or his chulos. Leave him to his academic researches. When it comes to politics on the ground, we know better. We know what has to be done. So they attend the Suda. What's the result of attending the Suda? What are the consequences? Zero. There are no consequences at all. Esther of Esther. What would we have said if we had been there? We would have said they were right. Mordechai is just out of touch. He doesn't know what needs to be done. And these people, where the political leaders, understand what the people need. Then Haman becomes prime minister, and the king makes a law. Everyone has to bow down. And everyone bows down, except for Mordechai. And the same group comes to Mordechai and says, what are you doing? Tell us, does it say in Shulchan Aruch that you must not bow down? We're as firm as you are. If it says in Shulchan Aruch, then we won't do it. Where does it say in Shulchan Aruch you can't bow down? Mordechai says, this goes according to one day in Chazal, Mordechai says, it doesn't say anywhere in Shulchan Aruch that you can't bow down. It's only a political law, not a religious law. I'm telling you not to bow down. And the people say, but that's crazy. I mean, we're going to risk terrible consequences. Mordechai says, I'm against it. What do? They bow down. Mordechai doesn't bow down. What's the result? A decree of annihilation against the entire Jewish people, Rahman looks like. Esther and Esther, if we had been there, what would we have said? We would have said that Mordechai is out of touch. And so drastically out of touch that he's endangered the existence of the entire Jewish people. Says Rav Dessler, but we know, with what is colloquially called 2020 hindsight, we know that Mordechai was right. But the lesson is, it didn't look as if he was right. All the pundits wouldn't have agreed. And those of us who are fond of quoting the local statement of the latest politico, or military leader, or economic leader, and even Baal Korchenu, knowing somewhere that it's not right, still we give it credence. We give it respect. And when our Rabbanim tell us something, tragically, we don't take it with the same respect. There's Rav Dessler. It didn't look right, what Mordechai was saying, but we know what was right, and we have to learn a lesson that's how one has to appreciate Da'as Torah when we have it. Thus far, Rav Dessler. I want to add that the turnaround, the Yeshua, was a result of their having learned this lesson and applied it. Mordechai comes to Esther, sends her a message, you have to go into the king. She says, you want me to go into the king? It's dangerous, I haven't been called for 30 days. I want you and all the Jews in Shushan to fast for 3 days and nights. 72 hours. The Medrash says that Mordechai sends back a message, but we are now standing on the 13th of Nisan. 3 days and nights means the 14th, 15th, and 16th, which means that there's going to be no Seder. No mitzvahs matzah, mitzvah deraisa. How can you get the Kodesh Baruch Hu's rachamim by violating his mitzvah? And she sends back, if the Jews are annihilated the way Haman plans, who will eat matzah next year? There won't be any Jews to eat matzah next year. And the pasuk says, Vayavor Mordechai. Mordechai crossed over, and says the Medrash, he crossed over his own das, and he accepted what Esther said, Vayas kasher tzivsa olav Esther. He accepted her command, and so did all the Jews in Shushan Abira. Now, I want to ask, didn't Mordechai have a logical argument against Esther's idea? Wouldn't we have agreed with that idea? You can't get rachmin from a Kodesh Baruch Hu by being mevatel a mitzvah. But the people accepted it against their own das. Against their own das. Because Esther proposed it, and because Mordechai accepted it, the people were mevatel their das to the idea and accepted it. And that was the turnaround. The turnaround was precisely in accepting Das Torah when they didn't understand it. Well, they had a good argument, and by the way, the argument here is very important. It's not that it's economically disastrous, or it's politically unwise, or that we'll have difficulties with the health service. Here it was a halachic argument. It was a hashkafic argument. They weren't stepping outside of Torah sources. They were using Torah sources to reject this particular strategy. And yet they accepted it against their own das, and that's where the Yeshua came from. And I think that's the lesson that Rav Dessler wants us to learn from the Haggadah, from Megillah, that the das Torah comes from a source that's higher than our world. The emes that's embodied in das Torah has more validity. I wouldn't say that the understanding of the service has zero validity, but has more validity. And when there's any conflict, the wise person will choose to accept Das Torah and be mevatel his das to Das Torah. As it says, if they say Ayamim Chashu Small, Das Torah Chashu Min, you have to accept what they say. And I want to conclude with a corollary of what I've said, which will be very unpopular, but I can't help but draw the logical conclusion. If the purpose of drinking on Purim is to reveal that the goof has absorbed kedusha from the avoda of a person, only a person whose goof is going to reveal that should drink. Only a person whose goof is going to express exquisite Avas Hashem and Avas Yisrael and Avas HaTorah, only such a person should drink. And the rest of us, we especially who are Ashkenazi Jews, should follow the Ramah. The Ramah says that Ein Sorech, there's not a necessity to drink to the point of Adeloyada. On the contrary, drink a little more than you usually drink, and then sleep a bit, and then you don't know. And the Mishnah Berurah quotes the Prima Gaudim, who says, V'chein ra'ui la'asos, it's appropriate to do so. My Rebbe Zatzal, the Boston Rebbe, forbade us without any exception to get drunk. He asked it, and there are other Achronim who also asked it, and we all know of Rahman al-Salam incidents, sometimes dangerous incidents, and sometimes incidents that produce a Chilul Hashem on Purim, because the people who drink and use it as an opportunity to behave in inappropriate ways. I teach Bali Tshuva. When they hear about the mitzvah of getting drunk on Purim, their attitude is, oh, so the Torah is more realistic than we thought. Once a year you get the Taiwan on. Well, that's realistic. You know, that's more appropriate for a normal human being. Chas v'sholem. Chas v'sholem. That's the imposition of a foreign, polluted culture on a holy idea, a holy Torah idea. If the drinking brings out the kedusha, that's the goof is absorbed from the avodah of a year, then it's a wonderful thing. I don't know how many people could say that they could guarantee that that's what will be expressed. If you can guarantee it, then under the conditions that I'm describing, it could be appropriate to get drunk. Otherwise, for the rest of us, let's follow the advice of the Ramah. Have a good day.